Hello, and welcome to Irish Imperial Lives. I'm Kate O'Malley.
And I'm A.B. Philbin-Bowman. And today we're looking at the life of a Catholic Irish woman who, from her home in Rathfarnham, had a phenomenal impact on the education of women and girls across the British Empire, from India to Canada.
She was a savvy businesswoman, a passionate educator, and not least, a devoted Christian.
And one of the things that makes this story so interesting is that what she is doing at one level is subversive, because she is empowering women, and specifically Catholic women across the empire, to unlock their potential. But at the same time, a lot of what she's doing is welcomed and encouraged by the British imperial authorities of the day, because this allows them to keep their Catholic servants happy. If they have, and they have at this point, a huge number of Catholic soldiers from Irish backgrounds serving in India, there are also many Irish Catholics who've moved to Canada to advance the imperial project. Keeping those people happy, providing education for their daughters, actually suits the purposes of empire. And ironically, it was often her own Catholic bishops who were the biggest obstacle to what she was trying to accomplish in educating women and girls.
Our guest today is UCD Professor Deirdre Raftree, author of Teresa Ball and Loretto Education.
And we began by asking Deirdre why Teresa Ball's parents sent most of their children to be educated in England.
For the Ball family, the choice of England was because they wanted to send their children to be educated by the Jesuits, in the case of the boys of the family. I think for the girls in the family, one of the daughters went to the Ursulines in Cork. And then they chose away from that for some reason and sent their other daughters to York, to the Bar Convent. My sense is that it was because there were other members of their social circle whose children were travelling to York at the time, and their sons were making the sea journey. If you bundled your children together and had a chaperone, it was safer and it was easier to send them to broadly the one place.
That's fantastic. I love that idea, that this tight group of elite Catholics in Dublin, they're working together, and even on transport and their education.
I mean, this is the first school bus in a way, you know, before such things exist. School bus, there's a whole sitcom there.
I should mention her sister, who ends up being Mother Regis Ball, is a well-known sister in her own right later on.
In the Ursulines, yes, and she becomes superior there.
And they had a philanthropist sister, Anna Maria Ball O'Brien, who was heavily involved in all of this networking early on as well, isn't that right?
She was. Anna Maria, Teresa Ball's sister, married into the O'Brien family. They were a very wealthy merchant family. And her husband and her father-in-law were liberal men who did not interfere in how their wives and sisters spent their money and their inheritances. Anna Maria Ball became a great benefactor to the Sisters of Charity, to other charitable initiatives such as visiting prisoners, visiting the poor in the inner city. And she also was a big benefactor to the Loretto's, to the congregation.
Yeah, real trailblazer and philanthropist, really, isn't she?
She was, yeah. She also had the advantage that she was a very close friend of Daniel Murray, the Archbishop of Dublin.
And that's influential in relation to Teresa's life choices, isn't it? Because it is the Archbishop Daniel Murray who suggests that she goes to the novitiate back to York, essentially, and then come back and open up a house here. Is that right?
Yes. You know, she went away to boarding school in York when she was very young. Yeah. Her father died when she was away. She came home at the age of 14, thinking that her boarding school education was finished and that she had left York forever. And within a very short time, she was being gently directed by Daniel Murray to consider going back and to becoming a novice, and to then becoming what he called a great foundress. So from a very young age, almost her destiny was mapped out in front of her. I don't think she ever imagined it would include what she later calls sending women to the four corners of the globe.
I don't want to presume to speak for teenagers today, but thinking back to when I was a teenager, I feel like if one of my friend group had sort of said, look, by the way, I'm going off to become a nun, the general sort of response would have been something along the lines of, but do you not want to, you know, go to college and finish your education and travel and see the world and have a career? And just when you spin back to the 1820s, becoming a nun is exactly what gets you access to all of those things. Because at that time, if you become a nun, you actually can get an education. You can be an independent woman. You can travel. You can have a career in a way that wasn't really open to them in any other way at that time of that society.
It was, and it was also a way that they had some control over how they would spend their own money. We're talking really at this point in the 1820s about a fairly small elite group of women that have considerable inherited wealth. They're allowed to use their dowries to found convents, And that's what they choose to do with their money.
Like, that's fascinating, Deirdre. There's a presumption that men were involved and or the clerics founded and funded a lot of this. But your research proves that that actually isn't the case, that these women, they brought money with them.
They brought a lot of money with them, and really it has only been in the last few years with access to more account books and registers from convents that we can see the pattern of bringing inheritances.
Yeah, and then interestingly as well, the significant money that they brought with them enabled them to buy some fine houses. A lot of English ascendancy people in the wake of the Act of Union would have left some of these, including Rathfarnham House, grand houses vacant. And they were there for the taking, really, from the nuns' point of view, with Daniel Murray and his big vision for what's going to go ahead. So is that how Rathfarnham House was purchased?
A lot of the properties that she bought at that early stage were either out of the encumbered estates courts, or she bought property that had recently been vacated. You're quite right. At Loch Cooter in Galway, for example, she bought out of the Galway encumbered estates courts. So some of the property was vacant. Some of it was becoming quite dilapidated. Some of the land around the property she bought had become very redundant. Rathfarnham House was an ideal purchase because for a convent or a monastery, as it would have almost been viewed, it was far enough away from the metropolis that it did not endanger the nuns, and it was going to keep your daughter safe if she was a boarding school. But it was near enough that it was going to be accessible by carriage, by horse, for the delivery of goods, for example. Mm.
It seems from the accounts it's a slightly chaotic start, but her own financial prudence really stands out. Just tell us a little bit about the challenges she faced, how she handled those.
Well, she had a number of young women who entered at an early stage, in particular the two Corbulus sisters, who each brought a dowry of £1,000, which was a lot. She only needed £2,000 to buy Rathfarnham House. So the dowries of her first couple of young women, in fact, covered the purchase price. And her own dowry, which was some £2,300, which her mother gave to her, mother hadn't died at that stage, that amount of money helped to convert and restore the building and add a floor, which would build boarding dormitories and make it ready to accept pupils. So it was spending right up to the end of your budget, as they'd say nowadays. Mm. But she had an idea of how she would recoup the spending. Part of it would be the dowries that other novices and entrants would bring. And there would be a fee-charging boarding school. And on the campus, there would also be a free school for the poor with about 500 children whose schooling would be paid for by the fees of the boarders. So she had an economic model. The growth happens in fits and starts because boarders did not always pay their fees on time. And this becomes a problem for her. She has to write repeatedly to some parents to say that their fees for their daughters are long overdue. But she had to manage this very carefully because a daughter in a boarding school certainly paid fees for 2 or 3 years. But the long term possibility was that young woman would in fact enter the convent as a novice and become a sister herself. So you certainly did not want to annoy or distance families who had several daughters in your school, because some of them may in fact become nuns and bring dowries. I think she was always trying to carefully balance one off against the other. Sometimes she didn't press for school fees to be paid by families where they had already given a daughter to the convent. But she was, I think, very tactful in managing that.
And is it right to say that it was something of a curiosity at that time, you know, that there was lots of kind of random callers and people, you know, leaving off children, presuming they'd take them in?
And she was in a Protestant neighbourhood. Sure. Her nearest neighbours were other Protestant landowners. So they were viewed with a certain amount of curiosity and even suspicion. They didn't have what we would kind of consider to be secure walls or an enclosure around the convent the way one would ideally have when you're going to bring a group of women in. And they often found that callers arrived randomly at the gates and expected to be invited in for afternoon tea or to have a guided tour, because these Catholic nuns were a bit of a novelty.
Of course.
And that was quite tricky at the start.
I can imagine. Yeah. And then, of course, lots of builders and renovators. And there is a substantial farm, or there was there still, right?
Yes. They developed the farm. The farmers helped them to be quite self-sufficient. And they also cut timber and were able to sell some of the timber. The difficulty of random people coming in, including builders and suppliers and painters, is that often rumours were carried out that were not necessarily accurate.
Of course.
So there was a bit of gossip value in having seen inside a convent when there were not many convents here at all.
And that's it. You have figures in your book, Deirdre, and correct me if I'm wrong, that in 1800 there were only 122 nuns in Ireland, and that by the end of the century there were 8,000. Mm. That's phenomenal, really, when you think about it. So in this early period, it would have been a novelty, clearly.
Oh, a huge novelty. Yes, yeah.
So can we ask then, how does that process of exporting this model overseas first happen? When does the first Loretto convent open up, and where does it open and why?
Well, her big overseas expansion period was between 1841 and 1851. And she referred to it as the period when she founded what she called our colonial convents. And accepting an invitation to India was the first step. And it was not a step that she took lightly, as you can imagine, because she had to get her own imagination around what it would be like to send a group of women so far away with no expectation that she would ever see them again. So she accepts an invitation to send what they called a colony or a group of nuns to Calcutta, and they make their first foundation outside Ireland.
Actually, Kate, you had a wonderful quote about the journey out to India. Maybe you want to read that.
The group bound for India in 1841 boarded the Scotia in Portsmouth on the 31st of August. Their journey ended 4 months later, though it was not unknown for the same journey to take up to 6 months, depending on weather. At that time, the route involved rounding the Cape of Good Hope. The captain of the vessel took particular care of the nuns who, on finding he was Protestant, laboured very much at his conversion. They were pleased to find him willing to at least make a quarter hour meditation every morning and also a daily prayer to Our Lady. The ship was also transporting many troops for the East India Company, and Sister Veronica decided to begin a mission for the soldiers' wives, giving them instruction every day. Mother Delphine Hart later wrote to Teresa Ball to let her know that it had been a very agreeable voyage with no storms of any consequence. Now, I think it's safe to say they were lucky on that trip, weren't they, Deirdre? Because the passage to India at that time would have been much more treacherous than they experienced.
They were very lucky. And subsequent journeys, because there are some very good ship diaries recounting nuns' journeys, they were very good at keeping a record of everything.
An amazing source for this type of thing, actually, historians might not be aware of.
And they usually record the weather and the challenges of being at sea in horrendous storms. Some other Loretto sisters, particularly the groups that went to Australia in the 1870s, described their ship journeys. But ship's captains, Protestant gentlemen, were extremely kind to having nuns on board. Now, I come from a seafaring family, and it used to be considered to be bad luck to have a woman on board at all.
That's right, yeah.
But they were often very, very good with the Catholic nuns, and they would give them a special piece of the ship. Space was obviously at a premium, so that they could have some privacy from the lay passengers. One thing that I've discovered in a few sets of ship records kept by nuns was that the captains would sometimes send to their cabins bottles of champagne.
Nice.
Because champagne was considered to be a cure for seasickness.
That's my excuse from here on in, Deirdre.
That's great. I don't know how kindly ship's captains took to having people advise them they should convert, but perhaps the 15 minutes a day was what he could negotiate in the circumstances. And of course, this period in the 1840s in India is really quite significant. One of the strengths of the British in India is that they don't try to convert the indigenous population, because they would have had complete riot on their hands. That would never have worked. But they do very much want Christian education for their own people. There are lots of Irish Catholics serving out in India. There would have been a considerable demand for female education for their daughters.
By the time she sent her sisters to Calcutta, there were some 800,000 Catholics in British India that had to be catered for somehow. So one thing that she would have been aware of is that those children will go to Protestant schools, or they will be expected to travel home, or they will go to mission schools, to some of the schools run by Anglican missionaries, for example, if there are no Catholic schools. So a response is to that need. Who will educate the Catholics in India? It's not really about evangelizing. It's about responding in the first instance. And I think that probably did draw her to accepting that invitation.
It's this idea that you have to follow your flock. And there's an increased Catholic Irish population after the mid-19th century. And are we right in suggesting that the British probably would have preferred English speaking at the very least, as opposed to Portuguese or French religious orders.
Yes, absolutely.
Occupying that space.
Absolutely. English speaking. And we have to remember with the Loreto Institute, they were known in popular parlance as the English ladies. She had been educated in York, and the women that she sent out would have been perceived as the English ladies who have arrived in Calcutta. Their welcoming committee, the Committee of Convent Ladies that was waiting for them, were actually Protestant ladies, but they were delighted to see them because they were going to send their own daughters to be educated by the English ladies. Their Catholicity is kind of parked sometimes. If it's...
They're respectable, right?
When you're that far from home, questions of Irishness, Englishness, Catholic, Protestant, they don't seem quite as important as they do in Ireland or you know, between London and Dublin.
Yes, I think that would be fair to say. And the letters and the accounts that exist that describe that first mission in India account for the fact that, you know, their Protestant doctor sends his daughter to school with them. You know, the various ladies socialise with them and provide them with the kind of furniture and equipment that they need to get going. So they have that kind of support. What they suffer from, ironically, is support from the institutional church. Their bishop is not generous to them.
That's interesting. So there's tension there, isn't there, Deirdre? And I suppose we should tell our listeners that the Loreto sisters are different in that they're not under diocesan rule. Can you explain that a little for us?
Yes, their reporting system and the way that they should take instructions, the sisters on the ground, very much was through their own chief superior, as she was then called. And Teresa Ball was the chief superior. And she had to remind some of her nuns in the colonies sometimes, you need to refer to me for permission to elect a new convent superior or to make a strategic decision about money. You need to refer to me and not the local bishop. And you can see she's saying this not to be difficult with them or to chastise them, but to show them that they need to be strong in their sense of who they are.
Absolutely, because Bishop Carew in particular is spreading them thin on the ground in India, isn't he?
Yes, he spread them thin on the ground. The unfortunate thing about that early stage of the India mission was that almost all of the first group of women had died within 10 years anyway. Mm. But he stretched the amount of work they had to do, made them take on an awful lot of work that they were not trained to do.
Yeah.
Including nursing, and they were not a nursing congregation, including running an orphanage. They had no experience of that. And moving them around the country where they had imagined they would have what religious call stability, that they would belong to the convent in Calcutta that they were sent to set up. Not that they would be sent into the hill stations and so on. He tried to take their convent from them to give it to priests. And then they also had to deal with severe health problems. They were not able to cope with the heat, and many of them got diseases. Some of them died from cholera, tuberculosis. So we see in the records of these, as she called them, colonial convents, we see a lot of death.
We should also mention Gibraltar and Mauritius, which I think is 1845.
So I have another one of these little quotes just to give you an idea of some of the personal lives of the nuns and a lot of the work you've done. There's an awful lot about politics and the realities of establishing a convent, but then we have this kind of happy correspondence. So Mother Austin Hearn sent Ball a, quote, good supply of coffee and arrowroot, unquote, which had been produced at their own convent in Richeter in Mauritius. She also sent her, quote, a small box containing preserved peaches, two jars of preserved ginger, one of preserved pineapple, and a small bowl of guava jelly. The jelly, she assured Ball, was considered very wholesome. And she added warmly, these are all trifles, but be assured they are offered to you with a grateful and affectionate heart and to prove to you that you are not forgotten. So I love this idea of a hamper from Mauritius arriving in Rathfarnham.
What little they could send, they wanted to send something. And what tended to travel in the other direction, what she would be asked to send out, would be books, sheet music, choral music, holy pictures, medals, for example, things that they could give to the pupils as little rewards and prizes. And she would send those parcels to them. And as I say, she also sent people. And you mentioned Gibraltar. And Gibraltar was another case where the Institute had to deal with a difficult bishop. And it's unfortunate.
These seem to be very common.
It's unfortunate many of these bishops were in fact Irishmen. But however, Bishop Henry Hughes was the bishop that asked for the Institute to send out some Loreto nuns to Gibraltar. And Bishop Henry Hughes had very clear ideas about what he wanted in a nun. He wanted women who, and I quote, were super excellent.
It's very Trumpy.
In languages. Super excellent. In languages, he wrote this, in languages and in music and so on. He wanted to develop elite education for Gibraltar. And he pretty much told her who she should send him and who she shouldn't send. But she was very clear that she couldn't spare exactly who he wanted at that stage. He wanted slightly older nuns because they would be wiser. They would have a gravitas. He didn't want young, silly novices.
Wow.
And he sent her a letter, which I found very, very poignant, where she had sent him out a lay novice. This would be a young woman who had volunteered to go to this mission in order to do the domestic work. Not an easy mission. And he said he wanted her sent back because she was, and I quote, a curious specimen of Irish manufacture. Where was she caught? This is racism. I don't think we could call it anything else.
Okay.
This he saw
but from a fellow Irishman.
Exactly. He saw this as possibly a rural Irish woman who was not sophisticated enough for the kind of convent that he wanted. He was also very concerned that nobody would be sent out who could possibly have TB. There was no way you could
know
if you were sending somebody who possibly had TB.
Impossible, absolutely. And Ball herself possibly had it, did she not, before
she passed
away. Yeah.
You've also alluded to other convents being set up in Canada. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience? A completely different climate, but with its own challenges, of course.
The mission to Canada, as I mentioned earlier on, unfortunately happened in Black 47. She didn't realise when she was agreeing to accept the invitation to Canada that she would be sending out women who would arrive into an extremely difficult context. They were neither ready for the weather and the cold, nor were they ready for the sights that greeted them when they arrived, which included that the bishop who invited them out died 2 days after they landed. So they didn't really even have allies at that stage. They didn't really have the kind of support network that would have been crucial.
Was it Bishop Power?
Yes.
He died 2 days after they arrived?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know
He had
that.
Been working in the fever sheds, tending to patients, giving the last rites, as it were.
Was it a typhoid epidemic?
Yes, the typhoid epidemic.
And that's a direct result of famine immigrants, is that right?
Yes. Scholars who have looked at the typhus epidemic in detail would say that it had been fueled by that wave of emigration from Ireland as a consequence of the famine. In Black 47, over 38,000 migrants arrived in Toronto between June and November alone, having travelled on ships that were mainly built as cargo vessels and in circumstances that were deeply unhygienic, for example. So we know that typhus fever is spread through lice and fleas. It's easily passed among passengers living for a long time in unsanitary conditions. They were in the holds of ships that weren't built to carry those numbers. So by the time they disembarked, often it would be quite some time before infected passengers knew that they were passing it easily around.
And of course, these are people with weakened immune systems through hunger, through starvation.
Absolutely.
Trying to get out.
Yeah.
You would think they don't be escaping the horrors, but in fact, bringing some of that horror with them.
Yeah. It's one of the reasons that sometimes people say, why were nuns allowed to travel first and second class? Was that not rather an indulgence to spend that kind of money on first and second class tickets on the ships? But their bishops and their sponsors were trying to protect them from the possibility of A, contracting disease, or B, fraternising with sailors.
Oh, okay. So that Bishop Power having died 2 days after their arrival, and I think what you'd mentioned when they arrived in Toronto, there was no welcoming committee. It's quite the contrast to India, where they had a huge welcoming committee. And I think you'd said in your book how Mother Delphine was quite alarmed that they had furnished as well their house in Calcutta, and that she was quite disturbed with the fine furniture and lavish carpets and everything. And then on the other hand, you have these nuns arriving in Toronto to this horrendous epidemic. And then this bishop is replaced by a French cleric, I believe, and that causes trouble.
Yes, again, he's not particularly sympathetic to them. If we try to see it from his point of view, what he faced was the fact that he had this group of Irish nuns who had arrived to open a school, again, almost all of whom died very quickly. One of them, she was wearing unsuitable light shoes that she had brought with her. While walking in snow, she developed gangrene in her foot. She had to have her leg amputated without anaesthetic. She died subsequent to the amputation. Three of the other sisters had travelled out probably with TB. They certainly became tubercular and died very quickly. So he had this group of women that came out, almost all of whom were either very sick or died very quickly. And he therefore nominated the one that he felt was left and suitable to lead, Mother Teresa Dees. He decided, well, you will be appointed superior over here and you will expand the institute here, and put a huge burden on her shoulders, which she had almost no choice but to respond to.
Okay. And how did she respond?
Well, she responded by what they almost all do, which is they write home to Teresa Ball in Ireland at Rathfarnham. Can you send me more novices? Can you send me more nuns? Can you send me help? Very occasionally they look for money, but mostly what the overseas houses look for is backup, more people. And she does. In those early colonial convents, as she called them, she did often send out more reinforcements and try to give them enough support that they would get on their feet. Usually within 20, 30 years, what has started to happen is that a convent is now recruiting locally.
Mm.
They're recruiting their own boarders who have become past pupils and who decide to enter. And then you begin to start a whole new life cycle. And the ideal model was that when you made an overseas foundation, within 20 years, it should be independent of the mother house.
Teresa Ball did not leave Ireland, which I think is fascinating in itself. And the fact that well, she went to England, perhaps,
yes,
or to Manchester.
Yes.
As a young woman, obviously.
But in terms of these houses, she didn't visit any of the houses that she, not to say that she managed her colonial convents from the comfort of her home in Rathfarnham, but there is a sense of that. She didn't visit any of them.
Yes. In Teresa Ball's time, travel was extremely slow and extremely expensive and quite dangerous. To make a visitation would have involved being away for several years.
Yes,
and the danger of doing that is an awful lot can happen while you are gone. You're not minding the mother house.
Yeah.
So she opted to stay inside her enclosure, so to speak, accepting visiting convents in Ireland, and she made one visit to Manchester.
If you were to sort of sum up the impact she had on that wider imperial world, was it a sort of a respectful relationship with the British Empire? Was she quite happily to be endorsed by Queen Victoria? Was there a mutual admiration there? Or was it a sort of a more uneasy tension? Because we think of the British Empire as essentially an exercise in putting a lot of white Protestant men in charge of a lot of other people. And so to be educating Catholic women, in some ways it's subversive, but in some ways also serves that purpose of the empire and allows it to kind of find its own rhythm. So I'm just wondering, how do you think about those slightly bigger questions?
Well, I always ask myself when I'm looking at the records of what Irish 19th century women religious did, what did they think they were doing as opposed to what were they told to do? Mm. Or what did their religious vocation impel them to do? And I don't think that Mother Teresa Ball was thinking particularly, I am educating colonial subjects. I think that she was preparing pupils for what she would have seen as God's empire, not the British Empire. And we get a strong sense in the records of many congregations that had houses in Ireland, convents in Ireland, that they identified with their congregation, that they thought less about nation and nationhood, and that they thought of themselves as a woman religious, first and foremost. So the rule that you lived under was what guided you in what you would be doing. And in her case, it was the education of girls.
Huge thanks today to our guest, Professor Deirdre Raftery of the UCD Schools of History and Education, who is the author of Teresa Ball and Loretto Education.
Also thanks to all of those who are responsible for helping us get the series on the air, to Jack Murphy, Elizabeth Larrigy, Nigel Wheatley and Sally Curran.
And I want to say a particular thank you today to Anthony Finneran, one of our listeners who wrote to Irish Imperial Lives at rte.ie, suggesting that we look at this whole area of Irish religious and their impact on the empire. And I think you'll agree, a great suggestion and one we were very happy to follow up. So thank you to him.
If you want to listen back to all of our episodes, you can find them on the RTE website or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Irish Imperial Lives.